Hello?
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm pretty good. How are you, sir?
Good. How were your holidays?
They were alright.
Yeah?
They were the holidays. It was nice to have time off.
Yes. How much time did you have off?
Just a couple long weekends, you know, the Christmas Day, Christmas Day, and I worked a little bit in between.
So you didn't take a full vacation or anything?
No. I mean, the weather's kind of crappy this time of year, and I don't have kids that are off from school or anything like that, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I usually will do Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and New Year's Eve, New Year's Day. That's about it.
Did you do anything for New Year's Eve?
No. No, I mean, it's nice to have the time off, but other than that, I don't even really think about it and go to bed at the same time. And sometimes we'll, you know, make something a little nicer for dinner, New Year's Eve or something like that. Or actually, over the holidays, in between, like after Christmas and going into the new year, I was actually pretty sick.
Oh, you know what? I was during, I would say about the 23rd, I started not feeling great. Mm-hmm. But, and my daughter was the same way, and we both had it really bad on Christmas Day.
Oh, wow.
Like, it was just a cold, but a really bad cold.
Right, same here. Yeah, it was, for me, it was more towards the following weekend going into New Year's. I didn't even think about it until I started thinking about New Year's Eve and normally have a couple drinks or something like that, but I still wasn't really feeling up to that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was just a cold, respiratory, you know, but it was a doozy.
Yeah, it was going around everywhere because, like, I even had, like friends outside of the area and stuff. I'm like, oh my god, I was so sick during like the holidays. Like, it's weird how like everyone it seems to spread everywhere at the same time, no matter where you are.
Yeah. No escaping it, I guess.
No, it doesn't seem like it. But yeah, so how is your it's the start of a new year. How has your new year been?
I guess it's all right so far.
Yeah, nothing special.
No, I mean, January, February, it's usually a quiet time of year.
Yeah.
You know, just, but I imagine that your kids were excited about Christmas and everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was nice. You know, it's fun at their age. You know, they get really excited and, you know, they get their present, and it actually seems a little bit more, believe it or not, a little more calm than even like a year or two ago, because like a couple of years ago it was just in I think part of it was that my wife was off on quite a few of these days too, whereas in the maybe it was last year or the year before, like the day after Christmas, Stacy went right back to work and I was off, and the kids were like insane, like with their gifts, like open this, open that, open this, play with that. It's like, oh my god, I can only do one thing at a time, and I was like just overwhelmed. But they seem to be, now that they're almost six, it's like they'll open something up and actually play with it for a while before they move to something else, whereas like before it was just one thing after the other, and it was like nonstop. It was a little crazy. But yeah, it was nice. And for the new year, I don't know if you saw it all, but we're trying to eat a little bit more healthy as you know, you try to make these resolutions. Mm-hmm. But rather than do a regular diet, like that really you can't, for the most part, people don't sustain those. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to change my eating habits altogether. So we're doing like kind of gearing ourselves towards like that Mediterranean style of eating. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you, heard anything about it, but they've talked about it in the past, and then it came up again in January, in terms of like it's being a healthy style of eating with, like, obviously a lot of fruits and vegetables, fish, occasional, you know, chicken, and very rare that you would have, like, red meat.
Yeah.
So we've been trying it, like, for dinners and stuff, and, I mean, I like that type of food anyhow, whether it's Greek or Mediterranean or, like, some Italian as well. So far, so good. It's only been going on 3 weeks now, but, I mean, I've lost, like, 6 pounds already, and
wow.
I'm enjoying the food, so that's the important thing. Yeah. That, you know, to keep that going, you have to kind of enjoy what you're eating.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's hard to...
So I wouldn't call myself a vegetarian, but right. Definitely is a... Like, I was actually saying to people, I'm like, there was a point, like, 5 days in a row, and I'm like, I have not had any meat other than fish for, like, 5 days, and it's not even bothering me. So...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, people just kind of... I think... we joke around about it amongst our friends and stuff, but my only opinion about what my friends eat is that they, you know, eat healthy enough that they're healthy, you know, because I like my friends and I want them to, you know, be around and be happy and stuff. Otherwise, you know, I mean, I feel like it's not none of my business, you know, so.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I eat. You know, just I eat fish, obviously, and
I was going to ask you. I wasn't sure if you ate fish or not, or seafood.
Yeah. Usually once, maybe twice a week.
Okay.
I'll have seafood, but
yeah,
eat a lot of vegetables and grains, obviously, and
yeah, it's a lot of whole grain. You have to eat a lot of whole grains and stuff, and stay away from sugar. And like, you know, that, like refined grains.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You know, we're going to do the best we can. We'll see, you know, we'll see how it goes. But I'm enjoying I enjoy that food. So it helps. And I'm not really changing like my breakfast. I don't eat a lot for breakfast. I usually have an apple and like yogurt. And so I'm trying to gear towards not sugary yogurt. And, for lunch, like, I still have, like, I just usually have, like, a frozen, like, Lean Cuisine or something like that, so I'm not really changing that.
Mm-hmm.
But, like I said, I mean, so far, so good, so I'll see what I can do.
I mean, especially in this country, really you just can do well by avoiding a lot of processed
foods.
I mean, and it's so... readily available.
It's hard to avoid it sometimes.
Yeah. You know, and a lot of that's tied up in the way that the agricultural industry was, you know, subsidized to grow a lot of corn.
Yeah.
And for corn syrup and...
yep.
That's in everything, you know. And I mean, but it's changing and people are a lot more educated than they used to be about what's in stuff, you know, and it's a lot easier to find out what's in what you're eating, you know.
Yeah.
But I think generally people just, if they stay away from fast food and like processed foods and stuff like that, and you know, actually, even if you don't have time to cook, there's options out there to, you know, avoid stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. So we started that, and it's going well. But you know, other than that, it's kind of the same old stuff. I did want to mention, if you don't mind, just a couple comics that I picked up recently.
Sure.
I don't remember if I think I told you, but I don't remember if I said it on the podcast that I got Flash 123 a while back.
Yeah, I think you did talk about that, yeah.
Okay, I couldn't remember, so that was exciting.
Yeah.
But more recently, I got another Captain America that I'm trying to get the full run of the first Captain America series. That started with issue 100,
because
mm-hmm. Prior to that was Tales of Suspense.
Mm-hmm.
So at my comic shop at Queen City, I got Cap 114. They had one in pretty decent shape. It was like a fine plus. So I got that. And then I was listening. I don't know if you listen to Mike and Kyle when they do their their DC coverage, but they were talking about they had a Plastic Man miniseries recently by Gail Simone, so they were just talking about Plastic Man in general. And it made me want to go back, and I got Plastic Man number one, the 1966 one, when it relaunched after the Golden Age, when DC had it. And so I got that on eBay for a really good price. I'd say it's probably in a very fine condition. And it was only the bidding started at $38, which was like really good. And I actually put a bid in right before the auction ended, and I was the only one to bid for it, so I got it for $38, free shipping too. So so yeah, I was actually going to read that today for the show, but I ran out of time, so maybe another time. But yeah, just got a couple things. But they were saying that there's rumors that they might do a Plastic Man movie, so I'm like, oh, I'll get this Plastic Man, because it's not like I'm going to go back and get a Golden Age Plastic Man number one, so no. Figure out I'll get this one instead.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I mean, it's cool that they did the miniseries. I like that character, and
yeah, it was pretty good too.
Yeah, Gail Simone usually does a good job.
Mm-hmm.
She's a good writer.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, Mike and Kyle, they tend to talk about newer stuff. I mean,
yeah, a lot of the stuff is newer, but they do go back. Like, they talked about Joe Kelly's JLA run and stuff like that. But
yeah. I mean, I usually look to see what they're talking about and stuff, but it's not usually stuff I've read or but it's cool they're doing that. It's kind of funny how things change over time, because what they're doing is basically what DC Noise used to be. Like,
really? That's before my time.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back before Daryl joined the show, up to that point, it, you know, was pretty much focused on comics.
That's pretty funny. That, like you said, it's almost like full circle, but yeah. Like with different
hosts. And then it just kind of DC Noise became what it is now over time. As you know, when Daryl first started joining Mike and Keith, you know, there was still kind of a comics focus, and then the comics focus went away over time, and at DC Noise, it got to a point where it meant something different to people.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So it's funny that, you know, then Mike has to start something called DC Noise or DC Spotlight. But it's essentially what DC Noise. I mean, my assumption is that, you know, they just wants to keep that door open to occasionally do a DC Noise episode.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure
the three of them. But really, you could just be calling it DC Noise.
Yeah, that's true. That's funny to hear that.
Yeah.
I noticed Nerdy Legion is with Nick and Martin are kind of, it's kind of the same way. I mean, earlier they would discuss whether it was like movie trailers or movies, comic book movies, or like the shows that they're watching, or you know, a lot of the different comic books that they're reading. And now it's like, I mean, they just chat about whatever they happen to be thinking about at the time, and like a lot of it is like cooking and recipes, and every once in a while they might throw, like, you know, like Nick might start talking about like whatever trade he's reading or something like that, but it totally, like, it doesn't have any type of a comic book focus at all, you know. It's just two friends chatting.
Yeah, at least Nerdy Legion, that gives them, that name gives them a pretty broad license.
Yes.
Anyway.
Yes, as really opposed to DC Noise. Mean anything.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that DC Noise is. But when I first started listening, it was right around the time that Daryl joined the show.
Uh-huh.
But I've gone. It's interesting to go back and listen to old episodes. I've checked out some of the early shows where it was Mike and Eric, just mm-hmm. to kind of.
I should do that. I haven't done that at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to kind of, because Eric unfortunately had passed.
Yeah.
Before I really became friends with people who had been friends with him.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of a way to get to know. It kind of started because Mike will occasionally re-upload the first episode they did together, or he'll upload the tribute that he did to him, and I heard those and then went back and listened to some episodes that they did together, and it's neat to be able to get to know Eric a little bit in that way,
mm-hmm.
since he was important to Mike and other friends of ours. But yeah, and then when Keith joined the show, it's interesting to listen to some early episodes, and you know, hear when Keith was super into DC Comics and just a different kind of show.
Yeah,
you know, so it was very, you know, hear Mike and Keith together talking really and being really focused on comics. It's interesting to hear too.
So, yeah, as opposed to, you know, the recent stuff.
Yeah. Which is
hilarious. Oh, I should have asked, are you recording?
Yeah.
Okay. I still have never added any of that stuff.
Yeah, I knew not to depend on you.
Yeah. No, it's a good thing.
So yeah. That's what's going on.
Yeah.
Did you guys get a lot of snow?
I haven't.
The whole area.
Yeah, I haven't been outside.
Dumped down.
But it definitely looks like we got some snow. It's so hard to tell, too. I don't know if you get the same situation, but when it's really windy, as it was yesterday and I assume last night, like, I have huge areas of my driveway that is actually, like, bare to the ground, but then, like, 10 feet away, I have a mound that's probably 4 feet tall.
Mm.
So it's like, I can't tell exactly how much we probably got, although, I don't know, looking outside in the backyard where it's kind of even, I don't know, 6 to 8 inches probably?
Yeah. I don't really, I mean, we get wind, but I guess the way that it comes through, it doesn't.
It even keeps it even.
It's a yeah. little more even, but yeah, I would say I was out there at like 8 o'clock doing the driveway, and it was definitely on the higher, like eight to ten inches or something like that.
Yeah,
but I mean, really, so far this year, it hasn't been a bad winter as far
no.
as snowfall and stuff.
It snowed a few times in November.
Early on, yeah.
Yeah, I needed to shovel like 3 or 4 times in November, and then that was like it until now.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy, but yeah, yeah, me too. I told Stacy that after we record and we have lunch, I'll get out there and I'll snowblow. So.
Cool. Well, Mike is obviously not here this week.
Did you want to make the announcement, or did you want me to?
What's the announcement?
That he's given up on comics.
Oh.
He actually has sold his collection.
Yeah, I couldn't bring myself to say it, so.
I know, and he is out of comic books, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But, you know, I never thought this day would happen.
No, I guess all that tweeting he did yesterday about how much he loves it must have just been a big distraction.
It was his farewell thank yous.
Hmm. Well, in that case, they must still be emptying out the house because...
Yeah, it could be.
There hasn't been enough time to get all those out of the house.
No.
I
didn't have a chance to see it myself.
Yeah.
Now it's too late.
It's probably still an ongoing process.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right.
But at least Barb can get our stove back.
We'll see if we can get him to change his mind and come back in a couple weeks.
Yeah, we'll do what we can.
Yeah. What can you do?
He'll just have to go digital.
Exactly. Well, that's what he said he was thinking about, right? He doesn't like the physical media anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's the case. But, well, what do you got for us this week?
Well, I'll tell you. I think I'll start out, like I said, I was going to do Plastic Man, but I ran out of time. So instead, I'm going to talk about the movie I watched the other day. And it's not the original, but the more modern one from 1982, Cat People. Mm-hmm. So this one, I watched Cat People. It was added onto the Shudder streaming service. I'd never seen it before. It has quite a few actors that I knew. It stars Natasha Kinski. It's got Malcolm McDowell, John Hurd, and Annette O'Toole, and also a smaller role with Ed Begley Jr. is in it as well. So a lot of people that I had heard of. It was all right. What it's about is this woman, her name's Irina, that's Natasha Kinski. She comes back it's set in New Orleans, so she comes back into town to reconnect with her brother, who she had been separated from, her whole life. Their parents apparently had died when they were very young, and they were separated, and she was raised in foster care, and so really had never known her brother. Her brother's name is Paul, played by Malcolm McDowell, and so she comes to stay with him. And it cuts back and forth between getting to know each other, and very, very quickly you see that he's very strange, point to being very creepy, and it keeps cutting to you see like this at the beginning, this prostitute coming into this like motel and stuff, and going up to a room expecting to meet a client, and instead that there's this big black leopard there, and tries to kill her and mauls her foot, and falls down the stairs, and they end up closing the door in on the panther, and this is where John Hurt and Annette O'Toole's characters get involved. They are zoologists at the New Orleans Zoo. They get called in, and they manage to sedate the panther and bring the panther to the zoo. So then in the meantime, Irina comes to visit the zoo, and this is for some reason drawn to this newly captured panther, and just like they're staring at each other, and they seem to have some sort of connection. And she's quick. Do you hear that barking? Can you hear that barking, Chris?
Yeah, I was gonna say hi to her.
Yeah, Latte must see the cat. Because we have a cat now, did I tell you that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so...
Either that or you're planning on getting it, I can't remember.
Yeah, we have one, and they're still trying to get used to each other. I mean, the cat is fine, but the dog just wants to play with the cat at all times, and
doesn't
quite understand that the cat doesn't play the same way. So anyhow...
It's like...
Yeah, it's a little crazy. So, the John Hurt's character is named Oliver, and Alice is Annette O'Toole, and you can tell that Alice, it seems like Alice and Oliver have some sort of a relationship, a romantic relationship, but Oliver seems very drawn to Irina, and they actually go out to dinner, and she explains her situation, and he offers her a job at the zoo, I think that she's just basically in the, like, the gift shop. And, but, you know, she comes and goes and has free access to the zoo. Ed Begley's character is trying to feed this new panther at one point, and the panther's acting strange and manages to grab onto Ed Begley's arm and rips his arm off, and he dies. And they try to euthanize Oliver, John Hurt's character, then ends up going to euthanize the panther to see that it's missing. And there's like a puddle of like weird, like, I can't even describe it. It's like goo, and like it looks like melted flesh and stuff in the cage. And so they're not sure what to make of that. Shortly after that, Irina's back at home, and Paul reappears, her brother, and they start fighting, and he starts making sexual advances to her, and she finds that disgusting, being that that's her brother, and she runs away, and ends up, there's a police car there, and so Paul ends up disappearing. Because she's a little scared, she brings the police into the house, and they start questioning the housekeeper, and she says she doesn't know anything, and they investigate and search the house, and they find in their basement that there's like cages down there and like shackles, and they see dozens of remains of like bones and skeletons and corpses and stuff. And so what they have as a conclusion is that Paul's some sort of serial killer, and he would kill these people, feed the corpses to the panther, and was going to do the same thing to Irina before he ran away. So they've got like basically an APB out for both Paul and this panther, because they still haven't been able to find either one. And then you see that Oliver, even though it seemed like he was with Alice, is continuing wanting a relationship with Irina. And Irina keeps rebuffing his advances, saying that she's not ready for a physical relationship. And so she finally goes back to Paul's place where she had been staying, and he shows up again. And this time he actually explains everything. And it turns out, as you probably can guess, he was the actual panther. He can change back and forth. And whenever one of them, and he explains that she is one too, and that if they have sex with a regular human, it transforms them into a panther. And only by killing a person can they regain their human form. And he further explains that their parents were siblings also, because these werecats can only have sex with each other. That prevents them from turning into a panther. And he tries to make advances on Irina again, but she won't accept it. And then Paul and Alice happen to come over just at that time. He transforms, Paul transforms into a panther again, and Oliver ends up shooting him and killing him as a panther. So there was one part that was kind of, it was kind of gross, but it's kind of cool. Oliver's doing an autopsy on this panther. He didn't see that Paul transformed into the panther, so he still didn't know this. As he's doing the autopsy, he starts opening up the rib cage and stuff, and like this like green gas starts coming out. But not just that, but a human arm actually like falls out and it like attached. So it wasn't that it was like something that somebody that he ate, but it's almost like the his human body is like inside of this panther body, and it was kind of disgusting. But quickly the panther starts like melting away, and just like we had seen prior, there's just like a bunch of goo and like flesh and stuff left over. So Paul's no more, but Irina was going to leave the area, but she ends up coming back and starts stalking Alice. She comes back almost, I'll be honest, almost like a different character. It, like before, she was very timid and hesitant and stuff, and now maybe because of the information Paul had told her, she seems very confident and actually almost like cat-like. So she's stalking Alice and ends up like even like trying to kill her, but Alice ends up getting away. But Irina goes back to Paul, and they go to this like bungalow out in the swamps, and they have sex, and sure enough, she turns into a panther. Looks like she, and then Oliver wakes up like, and the panther's on top of him, and he understands at this point kind of instinctually what's happening, even though he hadn't seen it, and he realizes this is Irina. He's like, Irina, don't. And she ends up as the panther leaping away and doesn't kill him. She goes back into the city as a panther and is ends up being trapped on a bridge by the police, but she jumps into the water, and Oliver chases her down back at that bungalow, and she's regained her human form because she had killed a person on the way. At this point, it's almost the end of the movie, and she's begging. She actually begs Oliver to just kill her, and he's like, I can't, I love you. And so then finally he says, well, then make love to me again and transform, and then I'll be transformed and be with my own kind. So he does that and has sex with her again. And then at that point, it kind of cuts to, you get the feeling like it's probably weeks or months later. And you see that Oliver and Alice are at the zoo, and it seems like poor Alice is in this loveless relationship with Oliver again, as if nothing had happened previously with Irina. And so, they're hanging out and joking, and then Alice kind of goes one way and Oliver goes the other, and you see him at the cages, and he goes to one particular cage, and there's a black panther, of course, in this cage, and he goes to start feeding the panther, and the panther like kind of walks over towards the bars, and he reaches his hand in and starts petting the panther's neck, and then that's the end. So Irina transformed into the panther, and that he brought her to the zoo to be a cat in the zoo. So it was a little bit slow. The movie was a little bit slow. It was almost a full 2 hours long. It was very atmospheric, I guess. It was that was the pace of the movie. It was just a slow-moving movie with bits of action in between. Overall, I thought it was okay. It wasn't bad, but it's not something I necessarily would need to see again. But I'm glad that I watched it, at least once. If we were given it a Netflix rating, I probably would say 3 out of 5, but a low 3 out of 5. Have you ever seen this before?
No, I've been long aware of it. Mm-hmm. It's one of those MXLX 70s and 80s films.
Yeah.
But no, I never ended up getting around to seeing it. The director is Paul Schrader.
I don't know. I'm not familiar with him.
He's a director and a writer, but he wrote Taxi Driver and Raging Bull,
And no, I had no idea.
Some other stuff that, and Last Temptation of Christ. So he's worked with Scorsese a lot, and then he's also a director. I think this was one of the first things that he directed, but he recently, we just watched First Reformed that came out 2017, with Ethan Hawke as a priest, which he wrote and directed, which it was, I mean, it got good, really good reviews. I liked it okay. I had some problems with it, but yeah, he's done a lot of stuff.
Yeah, so he's a, like, more, he's actually a decently known director, like, you know, in terms of writing, like, you know, a lot of good stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, honestly, it was okay. It was just, it was more artsy. It was trying to be artsy, mm-hmm. but it was also like kind of a ridiculous premise too.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like a weird mash of those two things. You could tell by the way that it was filmed that it was trying to be something, mm-hmm. but at the same time, it's kind of a silly idea for a movie, or not for a movie, but just a, you know, kind of a odd idea. And they just didn't jive sometimes, but like overall, like it was decent to watch. It was just, it just wasn't my favorite. But one thing I did forget to mention is that David Bowie actually wrote and sang the song during the end credits, which I thought was kind of cool too.
Yeah, I was looking at Wikipedia and saw that, and
yeah,
Giorgio Moroder was the one who did the score. It was like kind of a pretty well-known name.
I had seen the original one, and the 1942 one. It's actually on that list of the 101 horror movies to see before you die. Mm-hmm. So I had seen that one, and it's not very close in terms of how they compare. But of course, the 40-year difference is, you know, how, you know, what they would show in film and stuff is very different between those years.
Yeah, when your setup is like that, when the transformation involves either having sex or killing somebody, that, you know, like you're already like down, you're already heading down a certain road. It's kind of hard to if you don't want to take like a tongue-in-cheek kind of fun approach to it. But I think that they were kind of going for like a couple of funny things. I was looking at the Wikipedia page, and a couple, these aren't, they don't have a source for these comments, but according to the Wikipedia article anyway, John Hurd said that, I guess he says on the interview on the Blu-ray that he almost turned the movie down because he thought it was a porno.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say, no, the sex scenes I didn't feel were very graphic. There was, I think, really only one actual sex scene that they showed. I think that's the first time they had sex. They saw, you saw them preparing to have sex the second time, because he actually tied her up on the bed, presumably for his own safety. But I don't believe that then they showed anything after that. But there was, you know, definitely, you know, a lot of nudity in this movie.
Yeah, I think that's one of
Natasha Kinski basically, after the point of her finally having sex with John Hurd, that she practically, you know, when she's naked, like, she keeps just taking her clothes off.
Yeah, that's one of the things I knew about the movie, was that she spent most of it in her birthday suit.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, in her Panther suit. Like, it definitely was, like, I mean, he had a lot of pedigree in terms of, like, these actors, and I didn't know it at the time, but even this, the director, but, and, you know, definitely, like I said, it was filmed very seriously, very, very artsy, but, it just, I don't know, it didn't quite do it for me.
Yeah. The other thing I thought was interesting is, that Annette O'Toole apparently says on the Blu-rays that, the cats in the movie are actually cougars dyed black.
Oh, really?
And, because apparently leopards are impossible to train.
That's funny. So,
interesting production note.
But, yeah, that is. Yeah. It was, you know, I mean, it was fun to watch, but
yeah.
It wasn't quite what I, actually, I shouldn't say that. It was exactly what I was expecting. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't sure how much I would end up liking it or not, but it was average for me. It was something good enough to sit through and enjoy, you know, enjoy while I'm watching it, but nothing that I would ever be interested in watching again.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the vast majority of stuff ends up falling, right? Like,
yeah. I mean, you're right.
Sixes and sevens, you know, like,
yeah,
it was entertaining. Never gonna watch it again, but you know, because there's only, you know, gonna be so much stuff that's gonna be a personal favorite or amazing, you know.
Yeah, or on the other hand, like something that is just so god awful that you know,
usually you can stand it before you get anywhere close to watching it. You know,
right. Now, I wasn't going to cover this, but I just have to tell you about this other movie just quickly. Mm-hmm. I watched a movie about a month ago. I had never seen it before. I hadn't heard anything about it. The movie was called Pieces. It's a horror. It's a straight-up horror movie. Mm-hmm. I think it also was 1982. This one has no pedigree whatsoever. the movie, oh my God, Chris... It's very rare that I actually, at this point, anyhow, in my life, that I didn't know anything ahead of time about a movie, and it's just so, like, laughably bad that it's literally, like, I can't take my eyes off the movie. Like, it really was so bad that it was good. Like,
yeah,
it's one of those that you hear about, like, and like, oh my God, it was... Basically, the plot, just real quickly, was that when it's first a flashback to when this is a little kid. He's doing a puzzle. His mom comes in the room and says, "Oh, honey, what are you doing?" The puzzle is of a naked woman. She loses it. She starts like hitting the kid, you know, calling him all sorts of names, saying, "Throw this filth out," stuff like that. "Go get a garbage bag. We're throwing this in the garbage." So he goes downstairs to get his garbage bag. He comes back and instead with a knife and kills his mother, right? Then he goes and he hides in the closet. The police come and they see what happened to the mom. They open up the closet. They see this little kid. They say, "Oh my God, the kid managed to somehow hide from whoever this killer was." So then it's cut like 40 years later. And somebody is killing these women with a chainsaw on this campus. And the mystery is you don't know, you encounter several different people, but there's a weird janitor. There's the couple of the male students. There's the what do you call the person in charge of the university? I guess the president of the university. There's him. There's these two police officers that are investigating and stuff. And so you're trying to figure out, okay, well, who's doing these murders? The police officers enlist the help of this one college student for some reason. He's basically part of the force as far as this movie is concerned. He's doing everything but carrying a gun. And they get this, the only female police officer on the force, who used to be a professional tennis player, they get her to come, to pretend that she's the tennis instructor on the at the university, so maybe they can, you know, they can bait this person and this killer and with her. And at this one point later on, when you get a chance, YouTube Pieces, the movie Pieces, and put Pieces Bastard, and it will come up. At one point, there's this like marching music going, like playing really, really loud on campus around the locker rooms. And so as they're trying to find how to turn this loud music off, the killer ends up killing another student. And so after they turn this music off, they go back to the locker room and they see this, and they, you know, are very, very upset that somebody else has been killed while they were distracted with getting this music off. And the female police officer is standing there outside of the locker room with the student, the male student, and she's going, "That bastard was trying to, you know, this person was dying while we were trying to turn this music off. Distracted us. Bastard! Bastard!" It says it like four times. It's like the most hilarious thing, because it's like such bad at it. I swear to God, I enjoyed every second of this movie. It was one of the worst things I've ever seen, but it was so much fun. Right down to the end, which has this like twist, like crazy ending that makes no sense whatsoever, being like, this whole movie is not a supernatural movie. It's just a regular killer. Yeah. And like the end is like something out of nowhere. So it was just, anyhow, that's enough about that. But I definitely recommend, sometime if you have nothing to do and you want to see a really bad movie that will make you laugh, you should see Pieces. It was highly enjoyable with how bad it is. And it's very rare that I can watch, that I can see a movie that's really bad that actually, like, it's literally one of those so bad that it's good. Usually they're just bad and it's boring, but this was not. It was just very entertaining.
Yeah, it's like a lot of the reviews are on IMDb are kind of similar, you know, like it's one of the most hilarious slasher films and stuff like that. It's actually, its original title is Mil Gritos Tienes La Noche.
What does that mean? Something about the night.
Yeah, something about the, something has the night. I'll look that up, but yeah, it's actually Spanish production.
It was, there's just one more thing I just have to tell you. Apropos of nothing, the female police officer is searching the grounds of the campus at night, and she runs into an Asian man who starts doing judo or karate on her, like starts attacking her. And so she starts tagging him back, manages to flip him upside down and onto his back, just as the male student comes by on his motorcycle, gets off and says, "Oh, hi, whatever." And says to the police officer, "Oh, this is my judo, instructor. What's going on?" And he says that he had like a bad, I can't remember what he says, bad something, some sort of Chinese dish. And just leaves. And that's the only time you see him. He doesn't appear before, he doesn't appear again. Apparently, from what I read afterwards, is that the producer who is producing this was also producing a martial arts movie, and just thought it would be funny if they threw him into the movie. So, like, makes no sense why he was attacking her. Why, you know, he just gets up and leaves and says he had bad whatever, I can't even remember what it was, bad chow mein or something like that, and like leaves. I'm like, what am I watching? It was just fascinating, because it was just so bad. It's like, what in the world is this?
Yeah, those, but yeah. Yeah, films that are made not to, like, they're not going for high art, they're just...
No!
Gonna make something, especially back in the days when you had the drive-in theaters and stuff like that, you know, just make something as cheap as possible, and...
Yeah.
Mil Gritos Tiene La Noche is The Night, The Night Has a Thousand Screams.
Oh! Wow, that's it. That's probably a little bit cooler of a title than just Pieces, but it was called Pieces because the guy that was the killer was, it seemed to me, although it wasn't stated, it seemed to me that he was taking pieces of the different women that he was killing to recreate his mother.
Yeah, or I came across something when I was looking up stuff about it. It says, well, the description on IMDb says it's he's creating a human jigsaw puzzle.
Oh, that could be then too. Yeah, I guess that's true. But it seemed like she was wearing the dress that his mom was wearing when.
Yeah, it's probably some kind of connection there.
Yeah, but you're right. Yeah, because it kept intercutting like him as an adult, even putting the pieces again together of the puzzle. So that's that. You're right. That's part of it as well.
It is funny. It was. They do this with a lot of the Italian giallo films too, where you like the English title. It's not a translation of the original title. It's just something completely different. You know, they just came up with something that they thought was better.
Yeah.
But you look at what the literal translation is, and it's something way different.
I know. It's funny. I'm telling you, you. I mean, I don't know if you have any interest in that type of a movie, but it was just, I could not take my eyes off of the screen. I'm like, this is amazing. Like, what is going on? And like, wait, where's this karate teacher coming from? What does he have to do with anything? And like, nothing. Like, nothing is explained. It's just like, it was just, oh my God. I think you're getting the point that I loved this movie. I probably should have just talked about that instead of Cat People.
Yeah, I mean, I've been known to find that type of thing entertaining in the past.
It was fun. It really was. But anyhow, enough about all of that. What do you have for us today?
Well, I got a comic that's actually movie-related, sort of.
Oh, good. All right.
As it turns out, I don't know. I just was looking for something a little different to talk about than for a while now. I think I've talked a lot about a lot of DC and superhero stuff. And
mm-hmm.
So I was just looking for something different, and so I read a story. I read it in the Dark Horse Aliens Omnibus Volume 3.
Oh.
Dark Horse has done. Not, I don't know if they still have the licenses and if they still do it, but I don't think so. But, there was a time when, back in the day, where they were really kind of known for having a few of these licenses and doing a lot of Aliens.
Yeah, I think they still have Aliens, because something just came out recently.
Yeah, Aliens and Predator
mm-hmm.
Were big ones that they had, and they've put a lot of... Well, Dark Horse done a lot of these omnibuses that they put out collections of stuff, and this is in Volume 3. There's a one shot that came out in the early 90s called Salvation, and it caught my eye because it's written by Dave Gibbons with pencils by Mike Mignola, inks by Kevin Nolan, colors Matt Hollingsworth. Pretty good pedigree there. I like Mignola art.
Mm-hmm.
And I
was getting a lot of these Aliens miniseries at this time, at mm-hmm. that time frame, 1999, but I do not have this one.
Mm. Yeah, I haven't read many of them. I mean, I like the Aliens movies, but I can't say for sure this is the first one that I've read. I probably have read something at some point.
Mm-hmm.
This is narrated by one particular character. I'll tell you his name in a second. But it starts off when two men have been what looks like stranded somehow. They're emerging from what looks like an escape pod on a beach. Whether or not it's an island or not isn't clear. But from the narration, it's pretty clear that the narrator is a religious man. He keeps addressing the Lord and sees a lot of what's going on as a test of his faith. So that's sort of our intro, but then it jumps back to explain the circumstances, and both these men were on a ship called the Nova Maru, this company had recruited them. They says no questions, no answers, just money to man this ship, and most of them don't really know what their purpose is, what the journey is, what they're doing. They don't really have a lot of details. There's the captain of the ship, Foss, which is the other of the two men that we see in the beginning of the story. And this woman, and it's all men except for this one woman named Dean. And it turns out later that Foss and Dean are the two that actually know what's going on. Selkirk is the name of the main character, the narrator. And they're on the ship, and then there's an emergency alert that there's a malfunction in cargo hold 4. And as soon as that alert comes across, there's a bunch of panic from Dean, who immediately accuses one of the men, Stutz, of not checking. I guess he was responsible for that cargo hold, and she accuses him of not checking it, and Foss, the captain of the ship, doesn't believe it, and surprisingly immediately opens fire with a gun, with this big gun, kills Stutz right away. Again, so he's one of the ones that actually knows what they're carrying, and so his extreme reaction has to do with that. So he grabs Selkirk and goes through a portal, seals the door behind them, and gets in the shuttle that we see that they have crashed in already at the beginning of the story. He grabs Selkirk because he needs a pilot. He has some kind of fossa, some kind of disease. He's in a lot of pain. So that catches us up, explains the circumstances and what happened there. Basically, Foss knows what they're carrying, so as soon as he knew that there was an outbreak in that part of the ship, in the cargo hold, he knew that it was too late and that, you know, he wanted to get out of there as soon as possible, and, you know, didn't care what happened to the rest of the crew. He just wanted to save himself and took Selkirk out of necessity. So then we see them trying to survive on the island for a little bit, and Foss is getting more and more delusional and almost kills Selkirk a couple times because he's hallucinating and seeing things. One morning Selkirk wakes up and Moss is just firing over and over and over again into some kind of body on the shore. there's a bunch of like little pterodactyl looking creatures flying around. He's screaming and firing into this corpse, and Cell Corpse finally gets him to stop and realize that what he's firing into is already dead, but some kind of weird looking alien creature. And of course anybody reading this would recognize that it's an alien, the titular alien, a body of one. And Selkirk also realizes that this is what the ship had been carrying. This is what had broken out of the cargo hold, and why Foss freaked out. And so Selkirk tries to find, he realizes that if the alien is on this island with them as well, then the rest of the ship must have crash landed on the island also. And so he goes searching out for parts of it, and so that he can try to use a beacon to contact somebody to survive. But Moss ends up showing up and attacking him, and the only reason Selkirk doesn't die is because Moss's weapon jams, and at this point Moss is so far gone there's no convincing him that that Selkirk is not a alien. So Selkirk has to kill him. You know, and so as all this is going on, their narration is continuing, and he's expressing his regret for killing Moss to God, even though, you know, he says he had no choice. But he says what I did next was even worse, and he ends up to survive because there's no other food source. He ends up eating most of Moss.
Yummy.
Yeah. So Foss is by himself for a while, trying to, and we follow him as he's trying to survive and find the rest of the Nova Morrow. And he's in pretty rough shape, not hallucinating, but he's having pretty rough dreams, you know, just as he's trying to survive on the island, he's being bitten by bugs and scratched up by wildlife, and he thinks that he's seeing an angel. It turns out to be Dean, the first officer. It turns out that she survived the crash of the ship. So Selkirk's not alone anymore. But then, as you know, we're expecting, they eventually do encounter live aliens. And so they have some weaponry because Dean has some stuff from the ship. They survive their first encounter with the aliens. Dean sets up a sort of a diversion with liquid oxygen tanks from the ship to explode, and manages to kill a bunch of aliens, but not all of them, of course. Mm-hmm. So they encounter a bunch of them later on, and Dean gets attacked, they get separated, and Selkirk falls into, he says, this was surely the pit of hell itself, and he encounters, like, I forget what they call it, the mother, or, but basically...
Yeah, the big alien.
Yeah, that hatches them.
Yeah.
He encounters that, and... eventually he makes it back, and to the remainder of the ship, and he encounters Dean there, and it's kind of neat how this is staged. She's in the shadow, and he sees an eyeball on the floor, staring at him, and but it's not a normal human eyeball, and he realizes that Dean is not human, that she's a machine. So pulling in kind of another aspect of the films there, with having an android character.
Yeah.
So this is kind of where we get our explanation, such as it is, as to what's going on, you know. But it's kind of similar to stuff from the films as well, that they were actually meaning to deliver the company that they're working for was actually meaning to deliver the aliens to this planet. They deemed the planet not any good for terraforming. Single landmass, indigenous, fast-breeding natives, be the perfect environment to put the aliens there and have them sustain themselves, and keep them in this controlled condition as possible bioweapons to use in the future. But obviously it all got screwed up. So it's all about money in the end. And Selkirk, instead of fixing Dean, he just opens fire on her. The narration says, "I didn't kill her, Lord. She was never alive. Not really, no soul, just a puppet." And so he goes off into, he leaves the ship, opens the airlock, and thinking the aliens were just like Dean, inhuman, soulless puppets. Satan was not in the Mara. The real evil was much, much larger, much more powerful. And essentially he considers that the true Satan was what men call the company. And he just goes off on an attack against the aliens and using his weapon, the weapons that remain. And then he sets a self-destruct mechanism on the ship. And this whole kind of narrative has been his like confession to God before the self-destruct goes off. And as it counts down, an alien comes and crawls in and like comes close to him, grabs him by the throat, and you see like the, I don't know what they call it, but the thing that comes out of their mouth.
Yeah, the little tiny shooter mouth.
Comes out and is starting to, it is getting close to him as he says amen, and then the explosion goes off.
Hmm.
And then the very last page is kind of interesting choice. There's a missionary vessel, the St. Peter, and it's like got like big crosses on it and stuff, and it's been 4 years since they got distress signals from that planet, they are, as the nearest manned craft, investigating, and they confirm that there's no sign of life upon its landmass. But accordingly, we shall now resume our mission to spread the word of God throughout the galaxy. Our thoughts and prayers are with the souls that departed. May the Lord grant them true salvation.
Hmm.
So I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Sounds very interesting, yeah.
I think the thing with like the aliens and Predator, it's kind of like, it's about the, you know, they, even though the creatures are sort of the draw, there has to be that human element to give you something to identify with.
It's more, yeah, like for sure,
the seeing humans in different circumstances dealing with the creatures, and it was like I said, it definitely evokes, the script definitely evokes a lot of things from the films, but it kind of gave it a different twist with the religious aspect of the main character.
Yeah. And it's nice that it was a self-contained, just a one-shot story, too. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have a long, like, list, like a long mini-series or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, the Mignola art, you know, you kind of know if you like it or not. And it was definitely, I thought it was pretty well-suited to the story.
Yeah, that's cool. That sounds good. Might have to seek that out. You know what's funny? Speaking of... I'm thinking seeking things out and getting around to reading something. So I just started reading the Alpha Flight by John Byrne omnibus. Mm. But the thing that I have up in my queue next is... And I don't know if you're going to remember this, but remember when we did a few episodes of the podcast, just, you know, with me and you, we were doing one. Mm-hmm. And you covered Weird Detective number one.
Oh, yeah.
And so I read it digitally, and I thought it was pretty interesting. And I told you at the time, said, well, maybe when that comes out on in trade, I'll purchase it and I'll read it. So, you know, when the four issues were out and then it came out on trade, I ordered it. I put it on my stack of trades. Now, how long ago was that? Had to be like almost maybe 3 years ago, would you say?
Yeah, something like that.
Well, it's next in my queue. That's how long it's taken me to get through all of the like trades and stuff that I have sitting. I'm going to be sometime in the next week or so, I'll be picking it up and finally reading all four issues of Weird Detective.
So the stack or the queue is the trade version of the alphabet?
Yeah, but it's not in alphabetic order. It's just whenever I buy them, I just put them on top of each other. So it's like, I'm like, holy crap. Because the other one that's coming up shortly is Doom Patrol by Grant Morrison. It's a big, huge, thick omnibus that actually puts this Alpha Flight one. It's a shame. And I'm like, oh my God, I think that Stacy got that for my birthday like 3 years ago. It's taken me 3 years to get to this. It's like, I gotta start slowing down on what I'm... all the stuff that I'm buying. It's taking me years just to get to it.
You won't hear any arguments from me.
I know. It's crazy. Yeah. Oh, well. What can you do?
I mean, you could let yourself catch up and then, you know, the stuff's not gonna go away.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, I do get the majority of them now. I'm just getting directly from DCBS. And at least initially, I know that they'll come back and do sales and in-stock trades and stuff. But, like, you know, when I get it initially, they're all 50% off pretty much. So I am saving some money by buying it.
Yeah.
Then, rather than later, a lot of the stuff on in-stock trades are 35, 40%. Saving a little bit of money if I'm going to buy it anyhow.
Right.
But then on the other hand is like, if I don't do that impulse purchase in 3 years, would I feel like I still need it at all? You know, like maybe I wouldn't be even buying it and saving a lot of money. So
yeah.
that's the thing to consider as well.
So maybe just some kind of compromise between
the two. Balance.
It's probably best maybe this like, because you are disciplined about reading the stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Most people wouldn't be as organized as you are, and just kind of just buy all the stuff and then have it sit around, you know.
Yeah.
If you realize you're that far behind, you maybe can be a little more choosy in what you pick up, maybe.
And I feel like I have been recently. Maybe past 3 to 4 months, I definitely have seen my DCBS total, like my monthly order go down in terms of price. Mm-hmm. And that's a combination of series just naturally ending, you know, slash like Marvel, you know, every 6 to 12 months they cancel and renumber. And that, so I'm a little bit more choosy with, okay, you know, this volume is over with, how much to really enjoy it. You know, if it wasn't something that I disliked outright and stopped on my own, is it something that I really enjoyed enough to continue onward now that a new number one's coming? And sometimes the answer is yes, sometimes it's no. Mm-hmm. But I have pulled back on monthly, I mean, it's still probably more than just about anyone that I know other than Mike, but it's still probably 30 less a month than what I was buying before. And trades the same way. It's like, yes, there are some that I'm just buying, like the new Teen Titans. They're still putting out the trade paperbacks from the when they did those, I don't know if they called them the omnibuses or not, but mm-hmm. you know, then they'll break that up into whatever number of trades. So they're still coming out. Like the last previews had whatever the newest volume of the trade is. So, I mean, they're up to like volume 10, 11, 12, something like that. So they're past the initial volume of the initial first series. And now they're trading the second, the Baxter paper one. So I'm getting that. I get, not that I need it. I've got the individual single issues, but it's just nice to pick up a trade of 6 to 8 issues and just read them all together back to back, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm still getting that. I'm getting a couple of the other things that I've been enjoying, like some of the Flash stuff by Geoff Johns and Mark Waid, and so you know, I mean, there are stuff that I'm constantly getting, but I'm not picking up just a lot of stuff anymore. Kind of mm-hmm. narrowed it down. Mm-hmm. Which we kind of looked at our finances too, and it's like I can't justify spending this much money every month just on comic books.
Yeah, that's the reality you have to face.
yeah, you know, so it's fine, you know, I'm still buying plenty, but it didn't need to be quite as much as it was before. All right, shall I cover a comic book?
Sure.
All right, so as I mentioned, I've just started reading the Alpha Flight Omnibus, and although I was familiar with their X-Men appearances, I really didn't know how many times they kind of appeared before they got their own series. They were in a couple issues of The Hulk, they were in an issue of Machine Man, they were in a couple of Marvel 2-in-1s, in addition to the like maybe 5 appearances that they made in early X-Men before Alpha Flight number 1 even came out. So what I'm going to cover today is the one of the last ones that I read because I just got started, and this was the Incredible Hulk Annual number 8. And what we had in this one is that in the regular issues of the Hulk, between issues 237 and 238 is where this annual comes in. And the writers of this one were Roger Stern and John Byrne. The artists were Sal Buscema and A.P. Alcala. I'm not familiar with him. But it starts out with the Hulk basically coming down from the sky like a meteor crashing into the ground, and it explains that the Hulk had been hypnotized and sent flying through the skies by the power of Machine Man in Hulk 237. So this is him apparently landing from the end of 237, landing in Canada. And let's see if I can see exactly where this is. Here it is, northeastern British Columbia. So he lands like a meteorite, huge explosion, wakes up this woman who's actually out in a cabin at the time with her cat, And so she's like, what the hell? What, was it a plane that exploded? And so she goes to check, and she sees that there's a good 30-foot track of dirt, a whole trail ending in the Hulk just lying there unconscious, face down in the dirt. So at first she's going to run, but she ends up going back and saying, oh, he's not going to be able to breathe at all. He's still alive. So she does the best she can. She can't really move him, so manages to scrape the dirt away from his face so he can breathe. And she kind of moves away, falls asleep by a tree when he wakes up. And at first thinks that she tried to bury him, and quickly realizes that no, that's not the case. She actually saved his life. So, he picks her up and starts walking to, and asks where she lives and says that he'll take her home. So now cut to the Parliament building in Ottawa in Canada, and they have discovered that something had come from up in the sky and landed in British Columbia. So they realize that it was the Hulk, and they're like, we've got to get Alpha Flight out to investigate, see what's going on. They say that Alpha Flight is, five members of Alpha Flight are indisposed, and then it shows on the board, Aurora Shaman, North Star Snowbird, and Vindicator, who previously was Weapon Alpha and will later be the Guardian. And Sasquatch is the only one available. So they said, okay, let's get Sasquatch up against and see what's going on. So Sasquatch makes his way out there, and he's actually very excited because Walter Langowski is his secret identity, and he got his powers from a more precise bathing in gamma radiation rather than the Hulk, who was just exposed to a gamma radiation bomb. And so Hulk takes this woman back to her cabin and just kind of like hanging out, and he starts finally like resting and relaxing, and he turns back into Bruce Banner and kind of explains what's going on to the woman as Walter Langowski is being helicoptered into the area. And he is sitting on the floor of the helicopter meditating and turns himself into Sasquatch, jumps out of the helicopter, and starts leaping around the area trying to look for the Hulk. And, of course, before long, he ends up encountering the woman who went out for a minute, and Bruce Banner hears her screaming, and he comes running out with the rifle, thinking that maybe she encountered some sort of wildlife, and instead it's Sasquatch. So now, this is the part that I found kind of I found strange, is that Sasquatch, if you're not familiar, has all of his mental faculties with him when he's Sasquatch. So he's talking quite normally. He's very smart. And he's asking, he's basically asking Dr. Banner to change into the Hulk. He's like, we've got a lot in common. We're both products of gamma research. And, I am not interested necessarily in meeting you. I'm interested in meeting the Hulk. He's like, I want to study your transformation. I want to, test myself, you know, our limits against each other, and surely you can understand that. And he starts like really pushing him around and picking him up and bouncing him all over the place. And at one point he even says, come on, doctor, let's get that old heart pounding, because he knows that that's how he transforms into the Hulk. So he starts waving him over a cliff, saying, come on, let's get going here. I want you to change. Don't fight it. I want you to change into the Hulk. And, you know, I'm a scientist. This is like kind of like an experiment. I want to see which one of us is stronger. Now, I don't know if he just doesn't understand exactly how the Hulk is when he's the Hulk. He's not like Sasquatch at all, of course. He's, you know, he's very primal. And as he's dangling him over, the woman in the story is saying, you know, put him down and so forth. And while he's not paying attention, Bruce Banner's shirt rips and he starts just falling to his supposed doom from the cliff. But of course, just before he lands, he turns into the Hulk. So Sasquatch thinks that he's inadvertently killed the man. But of course, all of a sudden you see a green hand at the top of the cliff, and it's the Hulk, and the Hulk is not happy at all, as you can imagine. And they start a huge battle up in the mountains here in this wilderness, and much to the woman's dismay. At one point, Sasquatch picks up a full-grown fir tree and whacks the Hulk with it, smashes him into the rocks, and the Hulk just starts pounding on the tree trunk and smashing it apart until there's nothing left. And they continue their battle, punching each other, knocking each other around. The woman's cowering, for safety. And before long, because of their blows, they start an avalanche, and pieces of rock start cascading and is about to kill the woman. Sasquatch sees this and ends up leaping at the woman, and the Hulk thinks that Sasquatch has actually decided to attack the woman rather than the Hulk. So the Hulk does the same, and they're buried under tons of rocks. Sasquatch gets up first and has saved the woman. But soon after, the Hulk gets out of the rocks as well, and it looks like the fight's going to begin again. And he's just, you know, the Hulk is beyond angry, and as you know, he gets stronger as he gets angrier. But then he turns and he kind of sees the woman's face, and she's just scared to death of the Hulk, and that kind of calms him down a little. Sasquatch tries to apologize for his actions, and the Hulk, you know, basically he doesn't want anything to do with it, and he's like, there's no one stronger than Hulk, and Hulk and whaps Sasquatch backwards, and he leaps away. Basically, the woman scolds Sasquatch for pretty much starting this entire thing over nothing. And you see in the last couple panels, Hulk just leaping away and just thinking about the girl's face and how he only saw fear, and basically that the fear drove who he thought was a friend away. And you can see Hulk crying as he's leaping away. And that's the end of the issue. So it was interesting to see Sasquatch, who is, you know, a scientist, a very smart man, really behaving like an idiot in terms of trying goading Dr. Banner into becoming the Hulk, you know, and just they destroyed like the entire mountainside. So that was a little odd, but it was an issue that I had not, that, you know, had a member of Alpha Flight. I'm a big fan of Alpha Flight. I always have been. But that was an issue that, you know, it had a member in it that I'd never even knew about, and never read that one before. I didn't know that it existed. So it was fun to read that. I'm looking forward to reading the Machine Man issues coming up, as well as the Marvel 2-in-1s. And then there's another regular issue of the Hulk that has Alpha Flight again before we start getting into the actual Alpha Flight issues, which, you know, I have read those. But this is kind of fun reading all these issues before Alpha Flight number 1 actually got started.
Yeah, it's cool that they
enjoyed that. Yeah, it was really cool that they included all those, because I really, when I opened this up, I figured we're going to start. I forgot, I wasn't thinking about the X-Men ones that I'm very familiar with. I thought it was just going to start with X-Men number 1, but I mean Alpha Flight number 1. But yeah, it's got all their appearances. It even has before the next issue, which I think is the Marvel 2-in-1, just has a 2 or 3 page just little interlude where Vindicator just showed up on a couple random pages of a Fantastic Four issue. So it doesn't have the whole issue. Mm-hmm. It just has the few pages that he showed up in, because he wasn't the focus of the story, but he did make a brief appearance. Mm-hmm. So it's nice that this omnibus really is taking itself seriously, is that it literally is showing like all of the John Byrne stuff that he did with Alpha Flight, even if it was only a couple pages. Yeah. It's a complete thing. So I'm enjoying this so far. I'm gonna really enjoy getting back into reading. It's got the first 29 issues until John Byrne left Alpha Flight. So it's gonna be fun to read all that stuff.
Well, and that was Hulk issue what?
It was annual number 8.
Yeah, Hulk annual 8.
Yeah.
Well, keeping with doing something different, I read some Masters of the Universe mini comics.
Oh, you did, from the toys?
So this was put out. Who put this out? Oh, this was Dark Horse also. They put out, I think, about 3 years ago. I read this digitally, but it's I think they ended up doing 2 volumes of He-Man and the Masters of the Universe mini comic collections. Yeah, I think originally these were from the toys. It's interesting to see. So I read the first 3. The first 4 are written by Don Glut with art by Alfredo Alcala. And Don Glut, I believe, is like an animation writer. Mm-hmm. He's known for doing a lot of stuff in animation. But after that, there's a number that were written by Gary Cohn, the co-creator of Blue Devil and Amethyst.
Yeah.
With pencils by Mark Teixeira.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So then Alfredo Alcala does some more. Larry Houston, who's also well-known in animation, is penciler later on with Michael Halperin. Stan Sakai does lettering on a bunch of them. The Usagi Yojimbo guy.
Wow! That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, and there's a few written by Christy Marks, known in comics and animation. So yeah, so it's interesting to see like the creators that were involved. Like, this is all like early 80s. See, the ones that I read were done really early on. I think, you know, they were done preparing for the toys to come out. So it was kind of interesting looking at them, because they're not all, I don't know if all of them were, but definitely the first couple were done before the toys came out. So Alcala was working off of prototype documents and that kind of thing, where and design changes were made after the fact, so not everything is on model to what people became accustomed to later. And they're also, so the first 4 are done where it's just a single image with prose beneath it.
Mm-hmm.
So all the ones I read were like that. And then after that, when Gary Cohn, and starting with the ones that Gary Cohn and Mark Teixeira did, are our traditional comic book style, which I didn't get to those. I slipped ahead, and they look kind of interesting. But I mean, you know, He-Man is a pretty ridiculous property, in my opinion. You know, it's like they threw a whole bunch of things into a hat. And it's very commercial, very designed to sell toys, but it's also kind of what makes it fun to me.
Yeah, for sure.
So these mini comics kind of, I think, were kind of like a first attempt to create a narrative around them, and so it also, like, if you're familiar with the cartoon, it also doesn't really 100% jive with that as well. But the first one I read was called it's called He-Man and the Power Sword, and yeah, these came with the toys. Like, you can, the cover that they have printed in here still has the, like, little thing on it that says free illustrated book with purchase. excuse me, I gotta take a sip of water.
Sure.
Got an itchy throat for some reason. So yeah, it starts off with He-Man leaving his tribe. And it's kind of different to see He-Man just very, like, caveman looking. He's just got, like, a... the only thing he's wearing is, you know, like a loincloth type thing, made out of animal skin. And he's got a spear made out of, you know, chiseled rock. And he's leaving behind his people in the jungle, knowing that there's evil forces on the planet Eternia, and that they're seeking to control the legendary Castle Grayskull. And he needs to go out and battle those forces if he's going to if they're going to continue to have peace. And so on his journey, the first dangerous situation he encounters, he sees a female fighting this large creature, and using, like, magic to fight, but it's not really phasing the creature, so he jumps in to help, and he meets the sorceress. And the sorceress later on, like, looked a lot, she's the one that has, like, blue and orange color scheme and, like, a avian costume.
Mm-hmm.
This is, this sorceress is, like, got green skin and has, like, the cobra, armor that I believe Teela later wears.
Oh, okay, yep.
So, yeah, this character gets changed a lot, but she gives He-Man, the weapons and the like kind of harness that he wears, and it's this harness that gives him his power. She also gives him his battering ram vehicle. That's also a catapult and a space warp device. So then he meets Teela, who is being, she's in the midst of a battle with, Skeletor and Beastman, who attack her. Skeletor planning to make her his bride, at Castle Grayskull. And, Teela here having, looking kind of different. She has blonde hair as opposed to red. So He-Man doesn't meet them yet, but they actually knock her out and take her to Castle Grayskull. And we see, Stratos, who's like the gray bird type man, who's later on a good guy. He's actually shown as one of the warriors with Skeletor, because that was kind of like his original concept. All this stuff is like where this stuff is relevant, they have little footnotes, which I think is a nice touch as well for the collection.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. But you can also see Merman, real small. So we learn about the Power Sword and how Skeletor is seeking to put the two pieces together and the power that'll come from that. Meanwhile, He-Man's building himself a house because he needs somewhere to live while he's fighting his battles, I guess. And this is when he meets Man-at-Arms, who shows up in his own little futuristic vehicle. So they discuss, partnering up, to use their powers together. But He-Man tells him, I can't wait to travel the traditional way. I gotta get to Castle Grayskull as fast as possible. And he uses the space warp device on his battle ram and disappears. He's like, yeah, I'll team up with you, but I can't wait for you. So I'm taking off. While He-Man warps there, we see that Skeletor and Beast Man are trying to fight their way past this locked door deep in Castle Gate Grayskull to get the other half of the power sword. But they hear noise outside, and He-Man's using his battle ram running into the Castle Grayskull to try to get in. So Skeletor and Beast Man come out to fight, and that goes on until Man at Arms catches up and uses his vehicle to shoot down Beast Man, who's using the little laser cannon on top of Castle Grayskull, which was an actual feature of the toy. I remember playing with that. But it just cracks me up, like this weird combination of fantasy and science fiction that He-Man has.
Oh yeah,
it's really kind of funny. This one continues for a few more pages, but ultimately, in the end, He-Man, Man-at-Arms, and Teela are victorious, and they chase off Skeletor and Beast Man from Castle Grayskull. And the sorceress says that she sets it up so that from now on only the two halves of the power sword inserted into the lock on the jaw bridge.
No, of course, the jaw bridge. That's right.
That will be the only way to open Castle Grayskull, and that she's going to hide both the halves in secret places so that evil can't get into Castle Grayskull. And she disappears, and these new masters of the universe, they at this point Castle Grayskull is not going to be a place where anybody lives. It's just going to be locked. But amusingly though, in the next mini comic called King of Castle Grayskull, it starts off with Skeletor is in Castle Grayskull, so I guess he got back in somehow.
He's sneaky.
He conjures Teela. Now is so there's continuing to conceptualize all this stuff as they go, and Teela is the guardian of Castle Grayskull, and she's got her tiara and her orange hair now, red hair. It's kind of confusing because Skeletor doesn't have the power sword. Okay, I see what's going on. All right, sorry. I read this not that long ago, but I'm already confused. So it's one of those things where it sort of jumps ahead, but we do see. So amusingly, it wasn't too hard for Skeletor to find the two halves of the power sword, and so we're seeing what happened in the past and how we track them down. He goes and gets the one piece where Stratos. We get a much closer look at him now. He's not on Skeletor's team anymore, and he's the one that's guarding the one's half of it. Skeletor, but goes and gets it, and then the other half is picked up by Merman, who goes and attacks He-Man, and because that half is near He-Man's house that he built for himself, and He-Man has Battle Cat now, which is cool. He-Man at this point, it's his battle outfits, his outfit, you know, the harness that he kind of like straps around himself. It's not really a shirt, because you know, why would you hide those guns?
That's right.
But but so Merman attacks him before he can get one of those on. And that's kind of his weakness at this point. And so that's how Skeletor got the power sword back together and got back in there. So the sorceress really didn't do a very good job of hiding them. Teela is guardian. Later in the cartoon stuff, like the sorceress is the guardian, and Teela is like her daughter or something, I think. It's kind of like a miscommunication between the text and the art, because Skeletor's supposedly got like a clay mask hiding his skull face when he's talking to Teela, but the art doesn't depict him that way.
So he just has his regular face.
Yeah, you know, it's a, so. So that sets up the situation again that He-Man has to head to Castle Grayskull to take down Skeletor again, and he gets trapped in the same dungeon that Skeletor ends up putting Teela in, but it's not enough to stop him, and he breaks out, and him and Teela end up battling Skeletor for quite a few pages, and eventually Battle Cat and He-Man scare Skeletor away again, and once again kind of things go back to status quo. The Castle's Grayskull waits for the true king to come and claim his throne, and they depart, it says, as they departed, the spirit of the castle seemed to smile, knowing that at the proper time, He-Man would prove himself to be the true king of Castle Grayskull. So we get some, that's revealed, and we get some foreshadowing there. But and then the final one I read is called Battle in the Clouds, and they continue to kind of expand. We see more, a lot more of Stratos in this one. And for the first time, he has like the gray-colored fur that the toy does. And Merman is looking a little closer to his toy at this point too. It actually starts off with Stratos from his point of view, and he hears some noise and goes to investigate and comes across He-Man battling Skeletor and Merman. Well, Merman's just kind of hiding, actually, while Skeletor fights him. But Merman, we see he's got some ambitions beyond just being a henchman, and he's going to help out Skeletor, but with the mind of maybe at some point taking over and getting a one-up on Skeletor. Skeletor and Merman fire on He-Man as He-Man is leaving in his battle ram, and Stratos helps him out by moving the battle ram out of the way. So we see them like team up a little bit and become friends, Merman later on sneaks up on He-Man, and it's established now that He-Man actually has two suits, well, or harnesses, or whatever you want to call them. One is super strength suit, and then one is a force field suit. So he's got the super strength one on, not the force field one, and so Merman is able to hit him with this gigantic boulder and pull the super strength harness off of him. So He-Man's without, you know, his superpower, but he just has his regular old muscles, which are considerable.
Yes. nothing to be ashamed of.
So he calls Battle Cat and goes to his home. They find Man-at-Arms to get his help. And Man-at-Arms gets in his Wind Raider vehicle. Mm-hmm. And He-Man rides Battle Cat. They head off. They get to this huge mountain that they need to figure out how to ascend. Battle Cat obviously can't climb it. And it's funny, He-Man and Man-at-Arms kind of have this little, like, funny little argument that, no, not so much an argument, but He-Man shows his preference for his own battle ram, but Man-at-Arms has his Wind Raider and talks about how, you know, it has the ability to get up this rocky slope and everything like that. Meanwhile, Merman finds the battle ram and is trying to figure out how to get it to work and almost shoots his own foot off. So eventually, as the title of the mini comic implies, they end up fighting each other in the sky on their vehicles, Man-at-Arms and He-Man and the Wind Raider, and Merman on He-Man's battle ram, and they fight it out in the sky. The Wind Raider tips on its side, and Man-at-Arms actually falls out, but he doesn't get hurt because he's protected by all his armor. So He-Man jumps into the cockpit, and the two of them are fighting it out in the sky, when all of a sudden Stratos comes flying in and flies headfirst into Merman's chest, knocks him off the battle ram, and takes control of the battle ram for He-Man, and that's how it ends. But it's interesting to see, like, you know, they're really selling the toys, the vehicles.
Yeah, in this right.
Issue, and Stratos and Merman and Man-at-Arms are given a much bigger feature and close-up looks than before. So you can see that they're kind of like solidifying some details and how these characters look and stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's just interesting. I know I had some of these toys. I don't recognize any of these early ones, but I think maybe I might recognize some of the later ones that are more like comic book style.
Yeah.
Some of these, you know, as they kind of introduce some of the, like, the later characters, like the very first one that Gary Cohen and Mike Teixeira did is where He-Man meets Ram Man, which I know I had the Ram Man figure, and then the next one is where he meets Manny Faces.
Yeah.
These must. I'm assuming that these are the comics that came with Ram Man and Manny Faces.
I'm sure.
So maybe there'll be some familiarity to me. But yeah, I don't know. It's kind of. I remember when this came out, and I was like, "Oh, that's kind of cool." And you know,
I think that's. I like. I think it's interesting. Especially to see, you know, like you said, some of those early comics where, like, they didn't quite have, you know, everything set yet, yeah. You know what I mean? And it's like, okay, so, you know, not everything is the way that it ended up being. I always find that interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this stuff, you know, doesn't fall out of the sky fully formed, you know. It's
right, exactly.
People made it up, and it usually takes a couple of drafts to figure it out, you know.
Yeah.
To figure out what works and what doesn't, you know.
That's really interesting. I always find that stuff interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yep, that's all for me.
That's all you got?
Yeah.
I have, well, just one more comic book. I read today Batman number 133. So this one I got last year at the Niagara Falls Comic Con. Oh, by the way, I think we talked that, you know, George Perez is coming to that Niagara Falls Comic Convention. Mm-hmm. Did you see that they made the announcement that he's officially retiring from doing comic books, drawing comics?
I just saw that on Twitter this morning. I saw Derek Coward retweeted somebody asking DC and Marvel to take the announcement as an opportunity to reprint JLA Avengers.
Yeah.
So that was how I found out, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, he said, you know, between, obviously, he had that heart attack, right? Mm-hmm. And he said with his vision problems and diabetes and stuff, he's in a position where he doesn't have to worry about money, which is not a position that a lot of artists end up being.
Right.
But he is fortunate enough that because of the number of things that he created and the royalties that he managed to secure from those creations, that, you know, he can lead a comfortable life. And he said he can't do the quality of work that he wants to be able to do, so he's happy enough to retire at this point. And yeah, he's still going to do some limited conventions and stuff, so I'm very excited about it. So I don't know if you've made a decision for this summer, but I'm very excited to go up there. So if you're end up wanting to, maybe we could me and my wife goes to this one as well as our cousin, but you know, you'd be more than welcome to join us if you wanted to.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, him being there is, and the fact that he's kind of slowing down and what he's doing is definitely like a, it would be a good motivation to try and make it work.
Yeah, yeah. So let me know. You know, it's not until, I believe, June.
Yeah, but I mean, good for him. You know, like, I'm glad that he's able to do that.
To retire. Yeah, and I read his whole thing, and it's not a, he doesn't pose it as a sad story. He's, you know, happy with where he is in life, and you know, he's happy that he's can lead a comfortable life, and you know, so on and so forth. So, you know, he said, don't think of this as something sad. You know, it's just, you know, it's time for him to retire from that type of a grind. So,
yeah.
So good for him. You know, yeah. I mean, what a great creator. I think that he was probably as a kid starting to like notice certain artists. I think he might have been the first artist that I kind of like recognize, like, oh, this is George Perez, and to look out for his for stuff that he actually drew. Mm-hmm. He's like my first favorite artist.
Yeah,
I mean, still, I mean, probably one of my favorite of all time for sure. He's just such an incredible artist.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's definitely one of my favorites as an adult. As a kid, I didn't really. If I had been a little bit older, it'd probably been the same for me.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's what it was for me. It's just being a little older is like I didn't notice. I just took for granted. I didn't pay attention who drew or wrote anything. But for him, he was the first one that I actually noticed. Cool. Yeah, but that has nothing to do with what I'm going to cover now. It's just reminded me because I bought this at the Niagara Falls Comic Con last year. So Batman 133, it has three stories. The first one features the first appearance of Kite Man. So what you'll see here is Batman and Robin are going to go to they're going to visit a reception from an Indian Raja, and it's at the top of a skyscraper on the patio. So they go and they're all enjoying themselves for lunch, and nobody's noticing a nearby kite. It's of course Kite Man. He drops from the kite pellets of tear gas, and then he springs a kite out from his back, full of compressed air, and with his the jets that are powering it, he flies up to the skyscraper, flies over the Raja, grabs the ruby jewel from his headband, and punches Batman in the face. Robin manages to get his lasso around Kite Man's leg and gets pulled off of the ledge. And at that point, Kite Man starts taunting him, you know, asking him if his arms are getting tired yet. And shortly after that, he loses his grip, but he manages to twist his body into a water tank, and he dives into it. So the next couple days later, Batman and Robin are in the Batcave, and apparently Kite Man has done a couple other crimes that they weren't able to stop off panel, that they weren't there in time for. However, Batman says that there's going to be a kite skiing contest, and that he's been asked to be the judge, and perhaps Kite Man might show up there. However, on the way, what is happening is at the local prison, Kite Man has come in a huge, huge kite over the prison yard during the recreation period, and rescues one of the gangsters who has paid him off to get him out of jail. So Batman and Robin rush off to that to get there in time. They see off in the distance the prison and the huge kite, and they jump over to the motorboats with the kite skiing contest. And Robin jumps in the motorboat, and Batman jumps on the skis with one of the kites, and then he lets go and he starts soaring up into the air. He rams into Kite Man's kite, and they manage to knock him out, and they take him back to the hideout and they lock him up. However, he's in an old dilapidated room that has wallpaper peeling all over the place, and gives him an idea. He takes off one of his socks, his woolen socks, to provide himself with a string, and he makes a makeshift kite from the wallpaper and the string in the shape of a bat. And so he's hoping that Robin's going to see it in time. In the meantime, Kite Man has decided to get a bunch of other gangsters in the area, because what he would like to do is tie Batman up to a large kite up into the air, and then everyone can take pot shots at him like he was a clay pigeon. So he gets the other gangsters out, and suddenly Batman and Robin come out, and they've you know, sure enough, Robin has seen Batman. He's set him free, and they use one of Kite Man's kites, which is has a flash bulb, and it blinds everyone, and they're all captured in a net except for Kite Man, who manages to get away in his kite. However, Batman grabs a big dragon kite like a one of those Chinese festivals, and he manages to knock Kite Man out, and they put up one of Kite Man's kites in their bat cave as a trophy. And that's the end of that issue, or that story rather. So that was short and sweet and rather amusing. And the first appearance of Kite Man, who now is seeing very many cameos in Tom King's run of Batman recently. He's always showing up for a panel or two, it seems. And the next story was a story with Batman and Robin basically taking everyone out on the SS Batman. It's basically a charity event, and it's a styled a boat that kind of looks bat, you know, it's got like bat wings and a bat face on the front of it. And they have a replica of the Bat Cave underneath, and they take people on tours of it, and they stop at different ports, and all of the money is going to be going to charity. So Batman is showing people the fake Bat Cave and showing them all some of the real props that he actually has there. And he's got, you know, some batarangs. He's got the giant penny. He's got a belt buckle gun, and he's got the Jack in the Box that the Joker tried to escape one time with. And basically, what is happening here is that at the different ports, this criminal keeps trying to lure Batman and Robin away from the ship. And for some reason, but he's not successful after two or three times. So finally, Batman decides to put some UV light down on the ground to see where exactly this criminal keeps going to whenever he lures him out of the boat. And he sees that what he was trying to do is he's trying to steal that belt buckle gun. And so he decides that he says that they're going to have an auction and they're going to try to raise money. So first thing up for bid, of course, is this, because he wants to see who exactly it is on the boat that's trying to steal it. And because he doesn't know who it is up to this point. And the guy bids the highest. He figures that must be it. And Batman quickly captures him. And what it was in the belt gun's cartridge was a half of a map, and the criminal had the other half of where that led them to a place where a previous bad guy had counterfeit plates, because he wanted to pick up his business and do some counterfeiting. And Batman ended up solving that one. And then the last one is a very funny story with basically everything in the kitchen sink. It's got Batman and Robin. Batmite has come back, and instead of bothering Batman, he's decided to team up with Batwoman. This is a Kathy Kane yellow and red outfit. Mm-hmm. And so he's very, very helpful with he's not being a menace at all. He's being very helpful with Batwoman catching criminals, and Batman and Robin are like, huh, he's not being a menace, he's not being irritating, he's actually helping for real. Maybe he's turned over a new leaf. And in thanks, Batwoman gives Batmite a kiss on the cheek. And I guess she shouldn't have done that, because that encourages him to try to do make sure that she's seen as a sensational crime fighter and wants to up the stakes. So there's a gang of thieves that had robbed the bank, and Batmite says, okay, we gotta find these people before Batman and Robin do, so Batwoman can get the credit. He finds one of the criminal's shoes that got stuck in the mud. He brings it to Bathound, and Bathound takes him to where the scent is coming from at this warehouse. And so he brings Batwoman there, but then Batman and Robin picked up a lead and they're there too. So Batmite's very upset because he's afraid that Batman and Robin are going to get credit on this, and he says he's got to make this a little bit harder so it looks more impressive than just, you know, these guys. They're going to take out the criminals with no problem. So he decides to shrink everyone down to maybe a couple inches. They're very small compared to all the tools at this hardware warehouse. And now he's causing problems by accident. He actually didn't notice a fireplace bellows, and he lands on it and blows Batman, Robin, and Batwoman over. And the criminals try to escape, but Bat-Hound, who's still outside and full size, manages to stop their path. And at that point, Batman has had enough, and he asks Batmite to make them back their normal size. And now they threaten to give Batmite a spanking. So he just remembers that it's time to go back to his home dimension, and he disappears, and they all have a laugh over that spanking threat. And then that's the end of the issue. So it had three short stories. they were definitely fun to read. You know, they're as absurd as you would expect from, you know, the early 1960s. But I like reading those every once in a while, you know, something different from the current modern type of storytelling.
Yeah, they're entertaining.
Yeah, for sure.
Stuff from the era. I mean, it's not usually something that you just want to read for hours and hours.
No.
Issue after issue, but, you know, picking up one once in a while, it can be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a nice diversion. It's something, you know, light and just, it can be funny. You can tell that those, you know, those stories were definitely more geared to kids than,
yeah,
comic books these days are. These are, you know, comic book these days are pretty much geared to adults unless it's a kids comic.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Cool.
So that's all I got today.
All right. Well, I think that'll do it for us.
It's good.
Hopefully, by the time we're ready to record again, Michael will change his mind and be back into comics.
I know. We can only hope.
Yeah. Twitter's Rob is at Rob Krieger.
Mm-hmm.
KryGier.
Very good.
Well, it's right in front of me. I think I could spell it on my own, but but your name's right there on Skype. And I am at MythMaking ETC because my friends are old and can't remember anything if I change it. Mike is Mike Myers
Brunch, right?
Yep. And yeah, we'll probably be back in a couple weeks with another one for you.
Yep.
And Rob, you have enjoy the rest of your long weekend, I'm assuming.
Yep, we're off tomorrow. Are you off tomorrow?
Yep.
Yeah, enjoy. Like I said, I'm going to go and eat some lunch, and then I'll get outside and see how much snow blowing I have to do. Yeah. Unfortunately, with that wind, like I said, there might be a quarter of the driveway that doesn't need to be done, but then another area is much higher than the snowblower is, so then it's like shoveling first and then
that's always getting the snow blown. Yeah. It's always like the end of the driveway for me is like when the plows have gone through.
Oh, yeah.
They create the huge pile usually. That's takes a little bit longer to attack that
that's for
that
sure
pile that they create.
Yeah, but other than that, I really have no plans. We did our grocery shopping yesterday morning, got everything we needed. We're just gonna hang out probably at home today, and we'll see what the weather brings tomorrow.
Cool. Sounds good. Well, enjoy, my friend.
Yes, you too. Have a good week, and I'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Thanks. Yep. Thanks, Chris.
Yep. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.